This is David Wilson, and welcome to episode 33 of On Another Track. Welcome to On Another Track with me, David Wilson, exploring people and places from around the world. A podcast series that takes you where you've never been, and probably where you never want to go. On Another Track is speaking with people we can't meet with face to face. We use remote video technology and software to see what they have to say. You never know when you start these things whether you're kind of on the money or not. One of our podcasts has now hit something like 155 downloads. Doesn't sound like a lot, but you know, it's 155 people that I wouldn't normally have.
Yeah, you have to start somewhere. That's what Cynthia and I are doing. We're like, we just need to start somewhere and do this, you know? So here we are. Whatever, we can talk about whatever you want. I love talking to people.
That's the voice this week of my guest, Eric Setanarski. He's the co-founder of Samana Life and a sound healing practitioner. I first met Eric through Revenue Climber, which is a group that's run by Larry Cole, who you might remember from a previous episode of On Another Track. What I loved about Eric was his unashamed honesty. Couple this with his passion for social and environmental sustainability, he's in a great position to empower your people and your organization to adapt and thrive. He does this by giving you the social tools you need to survive in this modern world. I first got started by asking Eric how he got started in the business he's in now.
I have many strings to my bow, and I love the topic of this podcast, which is On Another Track, because I feel like I'm on several tracks. And I think one day they'll all coalesce into one, or maybe they won't. We'll see. Early on in my career, I was on the corporate ladder, if you will. So working in a traditional technology company, I was happy to be there, but there was something about it that made me realize that there was more. There was more that I could be doing. So while I was in service to a corporation, I wasn't necessarily in service to society, if you will. So that brought me to a university called Presidio Graduate School, which is an MBA program, but it's for sustainable management. So it's about how to use business to advance climate change policy, social justice policy, et cetera. So I started using my business skills to apply it for the greater good. So that was my first track that I moved off of.
Got you. And like you were probably saying earlier when we were chatting just before we started recording, it's always a great challenge to get businesses on board, isn't it? Because they have so many pulls on their finances, their attention, their time. So if somebody was starting on that journey that you started on and really wants to make sure that they can get a business on board, what are the kind of 3-point things that you would do? Where would you start?
Well, I'd say, first of all, so business is business, right? So a business has to be profitable, it has to survive. So really articulating the business benefits of sustainability. A good example of this is, which was a big one earlier on, is energy efficiency. So if you're running a huge warehouse and you have incandescent bulbs that are burning 100 watts, and then you replace them with LED bulbs, which are burning at 10 watts, you're going to start realizing considerable savings in your operations costs. So that's kind of the low-hanging fruit here.
So what are some of the challenges that you do find with businesses, though, when you tried to take them on that journey in the past? You know, that's an easy one. Like you say, that's a kind of tactical one that you can just say, this, you know, do that this week and you start making savings. But what about the more intangible stuff that businesses can't get their mind around? How do you tackle that? You know, like carbon offsets and things like that.
That's a harder one. You're absolutely right. When you talk about climate change, you talk about any energy efficiency or water efficiency, it's very broad. And it's like, how do you put your hands around that? But when you talk about how the impact of flooding, for example, can impact the bottom line in terms of insurance costs, you talk about how forest fires could potentially bring down your whole supply chain network, which it just did in California. So there's a railway, I forgot the name of it, and I apologize, but they have to reroute like 16 hours out of the way because of the forest fires that are happening in Northern California, which is a huge expense, and the whole supply chain is messed up. So it's these kinds of things. And then additionally, consumers are now wanting it. So when you tell businesses that, look, the consumers are aware of what's going on and they want to see you make action. That's a huge one. That's a big carrot for businesses.
Interesting enough, you talk about the rerouting of the railways. I think there's a lot of pressure as well, and correct me if I'm wrong here, that people want to buy local. They want to sort of get things more localized rather than things having to be created maybe locally. They go off to a distribution center in like 2,000 miles away and then have to come back into the local grocery store. Just, it's crazy, isn't it?
It is. And we've seen what's happened when you have such a complicated and large supply chain through COVID, right? So first it started with delivery of masks and things, and then now food is harder to get. So at least in the United States here, so we're down here, like there's signs everywhere that due to supply strain constraints, we don't offer this. So people understand that if you have local, you have more access to it, regardless of what's happening in the larger world and the larger supply chain.
You obviously have the social and environmental impact side to your kind of business, but you're now more on the coaching side. Is that correct?
As I was going through my studies in sustainability management, and they're really understanding the data and the large problems that we have to solve as a society. So climate change is very real. Worst case scenarios are playing out well before scientists thought they would. So it's alarming. And actually, it's so alarming that you can actually shut down, right? So it's very stressful to even think about that. So what I started doing is I have a formal meditation practice, as does my partner. And what I realized is that for the people that are doing this hard work around sustainable business, climate activism, social justice, et cetera, there need to be tools to stay resilient and to actually get back into the game so people can rest and actually be healthy and be balanced. So I took all these tools, I started training, I became a sound healer as well, which is another spur of my weird journey that I have. And so now we offer people tools to actually stay balanced and centered. And it's all coalescing now.
You very kindly invited me onto one of the days or one of the courses. And I have to say, I think I said to yourself and your business partner, Cynthia Scott, I think that's your business partner there.
Yeah.
I said, it was wonderful because I never had felt so relaxed in 18 months, would you believe it? And I just couldn't believe you could do it over Zoom. You know, I mean, this is the weird thing about it, isn't it? Because you think, oh, I've got to be in the class. I've got to go to the yoga class or the, you know, the Tai Chi class or the meditation class. You don't. It's just you're facilitating it. And it's the sound of your voice and giving people time to actually have peace, isn't it? And quiet in their time. You know, that's just some of it.
Absolutely. And I wanted to talk about that a little bit, about what you just said. So you couldn't imagine that you could achieve some sort of stasis and calm through Zoom. As mindfulness and meditation, all of that comes into the common vernacular, I think people treat it as almost like project managing it, where they have to have spreadsheets and apps and maybe like, you know, formal training with formal teachers and stuff. But one of the things we're really trying to advocate is that you don't need anything to practice mindfulness other than your intention and your breath. If you wanted to strip down to the basics, and you experienced that.
Absolutely.
Mindfulness and centered capacity can be everywhere. You can use it everywhere. You don't need anything other than your breath.
And I love that because the simplicity of that means I can relate to it straight away. You know, I had no intention, I remember coming on the course a few weeks ago, to actually do that. I thought it was going to be quite analytical and it was talking about the stresses and the wherefores of, you know, what we're all going through. And then suddenly it switched and became a practical session. And that kind of totally took me back. But it was a great experience. And it was a lovely feeling to actually say, you know, I just actually gave myself some time to relax, get my mind clear, and breathe for a change and listen to that breath and watch that breath, you know? And I thought it was inspiring. It really was.
Yeah. Yeah. Go ahead.
So if somebody was going to come on a course, give us a kind of broad outline of what you do in terms of your course structure and how you kind of take them on that journey.
Well, it depends on the course. So it's, what do people need and where are they coming from? Really meeting people where they're at. Some people are new to all of this, so it's important to give them some context and background. I'm a huge fan of science and data to support some of the more mystical, if you will, concepts, because it's really interesting how they're both intersecting together now. It's a discovery of the self first. So what's going on? Check up. And the way I actually define mindfulness is it's really about how you are operating in the world and how you're aware of how you're operating in the world. So what's impacting you right now? How is it impacting you? Why is it impacting you? And then here's a question that I added, which is really important, is how are you impacting others as you go about the world?
Amazing questions, because really that how, where, why, and how you impact other people, people don't sit down and think about that very often, do they?
No, this is a really good exercise that anyone could do. A good example of this is like going to a grocery store. So think about like, how are you interacting with people? How are you responding to other people? How are you responding to your environment? And just really being aware. And that awareness is so important.
You know, I heard somebody describe it as being in the moment. You know, it's actually stopping and being in the moment and thinking about where you are. What's the sounds? What's the visuals? What does it feel like? What does it smell like? It's being in touch with our senses again as human beings, isn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
So when you take people on this journey through all these different stages, and it's obviously tailored depending on who your audience is.
Yes.
What have been some of the great results that you've got at the end of it?
Oh, wow. You know, it's been, I think one of the things that keeps me going in this, really it's the tangible aspects of how people feel between their body and the mind. Like a great example is when you said that it was the first time in 18 months that you felt relaxed. That's magic to my ears because, wow, we actually allowed someone the opportunity to slow down and to relax.
Oh, man, you don't know how much it helped that day. My daughter, I'll tell you a little story, actually. After I came off the course or the meeting with you guys, with you and Cynthia, my daughter said, gosh, Dad, you look really calm for a change. You look relaxed. And I said, really? What do you mean? Well, you just don't look stressed anymore. You know, you don't look as if you're rushing around anymore. You look as if you quite have to sit in that chair and shut your eyes and relax and fall asleep, you know. And I thought, wow, Eric and Cynthia did the job on me. And I thought, I'm very, very impressed. And I thought, wow, these guys have got some sort of magic going on. But it's not really magic. It's about, like you say, it's about you being understanding of the stresses and the strains in the last 18 months and really adapting your skill set to a demand out there, really. And that's the point, isn't it?
Exactly. So I create the causes and conditions for people to heal themselves and to become calm and to understand how mindfulness works. That's how I view myself. I'm more of a facilitator. You know, I'm not a healer. I am not anything magical. I'm just someone who helps create the causes and conditions. And Cynthia is the same.
And that's a wonderful skill to have, you know, because again, you're not making any massive claims. All you're saying is, let me take you on that journey. Grab your hand. Let's go together and we'll enjoy this together sort of thing.
Yeah. And it's important to understand that it's your journey. So as you're going through and trying to become more centered, more mindful, it's really the work that you have to do. No one else can do it for you. An app can play in the background, but that app is not going to take you to any sort of mindfulness state, or certainly not enlightenment, if you will. So it's you. It's squarely on the person doing it.
Can I talk about the you aspect? Because I think this is very important and it's something I've experienced. And I know my background is from Europe, of course, from the other side of the Atlantic. And so we tend to be a little bit more in touch with the kind of the organic side of our lives. You know, things are, it's hard to describe, you know, because in the US and North America, especially, you tend to find things are up a level. You know, everything's very fast. It's got to be done quickly. You know, it's all got to be reliant on technology. Do you know, and maybe I'm off the mark there. Do you relate to that though?
Oh, you are so on point. Yes, absolutely. We run really fast here.
Yeah.
In North America.
Yeah. And I have to say, when I first came to Canada, I struggled to keep up. I mean, I didn't like the pace in any means. Now I've adapted. But what I do find is that I think people are really hard on themselves here in North America. Really hard.
Absolutely. Yeah.
How do we stop that?
You had just mentioned how in Europe, there's a more of a cultural norm to put emphasis on other things that are just that are unrelated to profession or attainment of wealth, attainment of status. And to realize that those are nice things to have, but they don't make up who you are as a human being. And I think it's really, really important for us to understand this. You might be a successful business person, but you're actually a human being first and foremost. And give yourself some slack. Humanity is an imperfect process. And sometimes we do really well. Sometimes we do really poorly. You know, sometimes you struggle, sometimes you're happy. And it's really just trying to find some sort of equilibrium between the two. And to be okay with it all the messiness that we have in our life.
Oh, and I love that you said the equilibrium, because the balance is so, so important. I mean, we have two eyes, two ears, two arms, you know, normally two legs, 2 feet, you know. And we don't realize that actually it's not just about the physical aspects of our body, but the mental aspects of our body. We have to be in balance. There's a yin and a yang, isn't there? There's that flow and backflow.
Yeah. And I always admired the work ethic in Europe, actually, because it's like, oh, I'll work hard for the day, but I'm going home at 5 to be with my family. Or I'm going to go on holiday for the month of August because I need to take care of myself. Like, that's a better model than 2 weeks vacation in the US.
Well, and again, that's shocking, isn't it? Because if you're not used to the US vacationing sort of rules, and it's the same actually here in Alberta in Canada, you know, when you first start working here, you don't even get a holiday or vacation to start with. You have to earn it. And then you get 2 weeks if you're lucky. And you think, really? I don't get to go on holiday with my family, you know? So have you done any research into the shorter working week and to give people more vacations? Is that something you've researched to see what effect it does have on the human psyche?
We have been tracking a study that's happening, I believe, in Iceland. They went to a 4-day work week. And what they did was, because of the economy being stressed by COVID, reduced hours. So everyone has an opportunity to actually work as well. And it's been really successful. And I'm tracking that very much.
What do you think leads to contentment and happiness, in your opinion, you know, for a human being? Is there some good tangible things that people can latch onto where they're feeling stressed, they don't feel connected with the world, they're not in the moment? Do you have any sort of tips that you've kind of picked up as you've been doing this course that really work and can work very quickly if they get engaged?
Yes. So I'll talk about the 5 aspects of resilience, which Cynthia Scott distilled from her work. Number one is having a sense of coherence and really understanding what the story is and what's going on, making sense of what is sometimes senseless. So if you're able to build some sort of coherence, so the forest fires that are impacting us now in the West up there for you, like, you know, what is the story about that? Like, what are we telling ourselves? Like, what's happening? The story I'm telling myself about that is we have forest management problems and we have runaway climate change and we need to address it really quickly. So it gives me something to hold on to and I have some narrative and then I have agency because I know exactly what the story is that I'm telling here. And then the second one is, once you know what the story is, you can have some agency over it. So you can actually control. There's that old serenity prayer from Alcoholics Anonymous, which I still love, is accept the things I cannot change and the courage to change the things I can.
Ah, that's interesting.
Yeah. To really understand what can you control. And sometimes for me, if I'm really stressed out about something, the one thing I control is that there's dirty dishes in the sink. So I'll do the dirty dishes in the sink and I feel a sense of a control and accomplishment for something. You know,
That's a really interesting point you make, because I often find that myself is that I've got hundreds of things to do. Well, I think hundreds of things, but you know, if I go and do the dishes or a practical, you know, thing, you know, like a physical thing, I find that it's great because it can dilute that stress. It can really kind of just subdue it a little bit. So your mind then starts to think again, you know, you start to think clearly.
Yeah. Yeah. Because we can take action on things. There's some things that we can't control, but we can always take action on one small thing. And that creates a sense of control. And so my journey into sustainability management from a business was for me to try to have some sort of control over what I thought was an overwhelming problem, which is climate change. So now I feel like at least I'm doing something about it, right? As opposed to just wallowing in fear.
Yeah, yeah. But people do wallow in fear, and it's very much a human condition, isn't it? It's indeed. That panic, the fear of flight thing. And I did read somewhere, or I think I saw something on YouTube from a guy called Dr. Berg. I find he's very practical to listen to. And he said that what we don't realize, and you might confirm this, is that when we're in that stress, fight and fear kind of situation, you know, the cortisol's levels go up. There's lots of levels of different chemicals in the body. But what we don't realize is that we can't come down very quickly because it's an accumulation thing over a period of time. And I hadn't realized that. And he said to get the cortisol levels back down again, to get that accumulation back down, it can take weeks. But there's certain things you can do, both mindfulness and relaxation and meditation. But there's herbal stuff and there's, you know, vitamins that you can take. Is that something you've come across with people where they've got this heightened stress? It's way, way up here.
Yes, yes. So that's a perfect segue into the third part of this. So the 5 point. The third is really the centered capacity and being able to manage these cortisol levels or this fear or this overwhelm, and to use tools to do it. Now, the breath, which we were just talking about, is one of the best ways to do that. If you can have even a 5 minute or less, let's make it really easy, 2 minutes where you sit and you can consciously breathe, you're reducing your cortisol levels immediately. Now, it'll take time in aggregate to get them down, but if you did that every day as a daily practice, over time, you're really helping your body adjust and get those cortisol levels down. Now, exercise is also wonderful, or movement. So being centered and using those tools takes you out of that fight or flight mode.
I suppose the other thing, of course, is not just the mental aspects of the cortisol levels, but the kind of physical damage it does to your body over a period of time. I imagine that's quite extreme sometimes, eh?
Very much. So it impacts, high stress impacts the whole body, all of the systems, the digestive system, the endocrine system, the nervous system, all of it. Because what's happening is when your body still thinks that we're on the savannah, that's, you know, we're about to get like attacked by a lion. So everything shuts down because you're saving your energy to run away from the lion. But as we know, in modern world, the lions are generally imaginary. It's like a bad email. So it's not really a threat. But we perceive it as such. And it's real because we perceive it that way.
Yeah. And it's funny you talk about the bad email. I you know, this is the thing, as human beings, this is a microsecond of the last second of the last minute of, you know, evolution, isn't it? For human beings, we're in this sort of, it's crazy. And we've never, you know, our ancestors never had to deal with constant switched on communication, you know, constantly plugged in, constantly reacting to things, you know, because you look at all the software we have, the apps we have, it's all about reactions, isn't it?
It's all about reactions. Yes. I was just reading an interesting design piece about notifications and how to better design them so they're more in line with how nature works, as opposed to like having everything like, you have a new text, you have a new mail, you have like, even though I have a mindfulness practice, when I see that red dot badge on my thing, I am so curious to open it up and see what's going on, right?
Definitely. And that word you use, the key word is curiosity, isn't it? It doesn't ever leave us. Although people are more curious than others, curiosity as human beings doesn't leave us. And it's part of the element of learning, isn't it? You know, being able to sort of discover things. So it's natural for us to be curious, but it's not natural to be curious 100% of the day. Well, not 100%, but you know, the waking hours that we're around, it's crazy really, isn't it?
Yeah. It's the attention economy is what they're calling it now. So everyone's looking to get your attention.
Okay. I think we got to number three. Is that correct? We're at number four then. Is that correct?
Correct. So this is challenge and really navigating challenge. So when you have a story and then you're able to control some things and then you're able to center yourself somewhat, what you realize is that the world is constantly in flux. And I would say since the start of 2020, the world has been like on overdrive. I can't even keep track of what is going on anymore. So
it's crazy. Yeah.
So we try to teach people how to navigate change in a way that makes it so you have more agency and control again. So you understand that change is the constant, right? That's the adage we've all heard. Change is the constant. And it is. Or how do we survive in a world that's constantly changing?
Yeah. And I want to ask about change a little bit. I think, you might be able to correct me on this. I come from a background of gypsies, would you believe, going way, way back, you know? So we were always used to change, you know, in Northern Ireland, Scotland. We'd go around and do the horse fairs every summer and spring and autumn or fall. And, you know, our lives were full of change. But there was a cycle to it. That was the lovely thing about it. It was this sort of, you know, lovely seasonal cycle. So we expected change. We knew what the change was going to be. And it varied a little bit along that journey. And that's something I found in my life, modern life. I do like to have some change. I like that kind of variety of traveling to places. Do you think as human beings now in modern society, and I'm saying the past probably 20 years, maybe 30 years, that we're kind of not used to that natural change anymore, visiting people, going to see relatives, friends, families in different locations, which was common way, way back 20, 30, 40 years ago? Do we find that because we've become more isolated, we've become more electronic based, is that affecting the way that we deal with change now, do you think?
That's a really interesting question. I never thought about it from that angle. I'd say we're probably experiencing more change than when just visiting or being more of a gypsy. And that was actually, there was more control in some of that because it was part of the process. Whereas, you know, a pandemic is something that's not in our control per se. And I think that to your point, the whole electronic universe that we now exist in, right? So we, especially after the pandemic, we exist in this virtual world, and that's constantly changing all the time too. And I would say that we're changing much, much, much more and much more rapidly than we have the capacity to actually deal with on a healthy level, which is why tools are necessary.
Yeah. And I think you've hit the money in the head because, you know, tools or filters are important. Don't feel that you can't switch notifications off. Don't feel you can't filter this or unsubscribe. I mean, it's a great feeling when you unsubscribe. You don't have that email coming in or that notification coming in and going ding, 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 you know, and you get it down to a manageable level. That's a wonderful feeling.
And I think if you were to take away one thing from navigating change is to really understand that change, while it can be very threatening, change is also an opportunity. And to really frame it as an opportunity, a lot of people have done that over the pandemic and are flourishing because they're like, okay, well, here's where the world is, so let me take advantage of that.
And it's about perspective, isn't it? That's really kind of what you're saying. If you shift that perspective to a slightly different viewpoint, you can then be re-energized and gain something from that.
Exactly. You know, change can be stress inducing, but then you can use your tools for standard capacity. So walk yourself off the ledge, stop being resistant and be like, okay, well, what are the opportunities for me in this change?
Okay. So I think we're on to point number five now.
We are. And that's developing resilient connections with people. So our networks of people are so, so important. There's so much research that shows how human beings are generally happier, healthier, and live longer when they have a support network around them. And that means family, that means friends, that means community outreach, that means all of it. And really understanding how you keep those connections deep. One of the things that I'm really thinking about with the climate change, going back to that again, is I'm like, oh my gosh, what am I going to do if I have to leave California? And I'm like, well, there's a lot of other people who are talking about this. So I don't have to drift alone in this. I can get involved in the conversation and meet and talk to other people and build connections around people who are talking about climate change. And then I feel better.
You know, and it's such a simple thing that you've said there. I think there's a fear because now we hide behind the electronics and the Facebooks or the LinkedIns. It gives us that kind of slightly barrier, you know, that barrier to feel safe. But really, it's counterintuitive for human beings to really do that. You know, you should be reaching out and making those network connections and take a little bit of faith in yourself that people will want to talk to you. There's similar people out there that have got similar passions and pastimes or ambitions. And like you just said, you've got to reach out to these people because it does make you feel good. There's a connection. What do they say? It's like almost like it's feeding the soul, isn't it? You know, you've got a soulmate. You got somebody who understands where you're coming from. And that means so much, doesn't it?
It really does. So even us introverts need to have people in our lives because we are a social species.
Totally.
And it's really important.
You know, when you were talking earlier on about, you know, the kind of the cycle of things, like, for instance, you just get all this information and you think, well, how do we send messages now that are more intuitive for the human psyche and the human soul? And as maybe we make app seasonal. There you are. I've just thought of that at left field. So you have that seasonal app. Well, we're going to go to the spring and this is where you're going to get the communication about this to set you up for summer. And this will make you feel great and you'll go through in winter and it'll roll down a little bit. And then you get ready for winter. You know, I don't know.
I love it. I love it. A whole seasonal app selection.
Yeah. We'll take care of your soulfulness, your mindfulness, and we'll take care of all the things that just cause you problems year in, year out. And so that's going back to being the gypsy, you know, the gypsy app. You know, you can go and do your thing like that.
I like it. I think you have something there.
You're halfway through listening to On Another Track with me, David Wilson. My guest this week is Eric Setanarski from Samana Life. Next, I want to ask Eric a little bit more about his backstory and also a little bit about the family.
Eric is from New England. I was raised in a working class town in central Connecticut. That's where I came from. So I was raised in the 70s. I'm Gen X. There's not many of us, but I'm a Gen X.
What did that mean, being raised in a, and was it a small town or a medium-sized town?
Oh, it was a city of 60,000 people, so pretty small.
Okay, name, for instance? Name of the town?
Oh, Meriden, Connecticut.
So what was that kind of experience like, being kind of the 70s kid and into the 80s? Tell me some of the tangible things that happened, and what were the good and bad?
So going back to community, still have that community cohesiveness, which in a lot of small and medium-sized cities in the U.S. at least, that cohesiveness is disappearing. So it was just really lovely. You know, we'd have festivals downtown. So that was a wonderful aspect of living in that community. I really appreciate it now. That said, it was somewhat of a conservative community. People think New England, New England's pretty conservative, actually. I was going to say people think of it as conservative. So although it's pretty liberal, it's a blue area in terms of, you know, voting. But I've always been more of a radical in the way I think about things. And it always caused trouble. So
I love it. God, tell me more about that. Because this is the nitty gritty. I love getting into this because, you know, where did that inspiration come from? Why were you so radical? And what did you do that was so different that rubbed them up the wrong way?
It was a bunch of things. So, I mean, well, I'm queer to start. So back in the 80s, in this, you know, back then, like, it wasn't as accepted. So I was always living, you know, in the closet.
Yeah.
That's the term, in the closet. So there was always this, and I was like, this is stupid. Why am I doing that? Like, you know, but I didn't have any community to talk to. So I was always like, I was starting to question just established mores and established values and be like, well, why don't I have a place in this conversation as, you know, and I stayed in the closet until I'd left Central Connecticut. So that was one of the things. I actually don't know how, but I started just looking around and being like, wow, there's a lot of things that are really weird. And then I had this speech for high school that was called The End of the American Dream. It was talking about how runaway capitalism will destroy the American fabric, and kind of is. And all this stuff. So that was kind of me. Like, I was in this like weird, I was one of the alternative kids. So there was always this tension between fitting in and then being radical. And I chose the radical route.
Yeah.
As much as I love the town, I went to school in Boston and went to the big city to find that connection. And that was the next part of my journey.
Got you. And thank you for being so candid there, because, you know, I'd love to ask you about that, being, you call it queer or a gay guy.
I'm gay.
I mean, you know, again, it's just a label, you know, this is it. But the point being is that it must have been like, now I understand completely where you're coming from in terms of, you know, that juxtaposition of where you were coming from and where that conservative, you know, environment you were in. So what were some of the things that were really interesting challenges, but really made the person you are now from that environment you're in?
Yeah. So when I finally accepted who I was and came out, I mean, I came out and then I was like, I'm coming out, like, forget it. Like, and I really stepped into myself and who I was as a human being. It was a beautiful thing to really I just owned who I was.
Got you.
And I didn't care necessarily. It took a while, by the way. It wasn't instant, because I was going in between, but I didn't care what people thought of me, because I just needed to own my truth, which was that I was a gay male. And whether you wanted to accept me or not, it didn't matter. And it was really, really, really powerful and inspiring. It was very inspiring.
And liberating, I'd imagine, because it was like a weight eventually was lifted off the shoulders. You know, you could be who you were.
It was. And this is a funny sidebar, but I always think about this. So I was never really good at sports when I was younger, in high school or whatever.
Me too.
There was a lot of pressure to be, but part of the reason why I was like, because I was thinking like, well, I'm gay, like I should be more girly girl. And once I owned my sexuality, I actually became really good at sports, and I became much more like of an adventure, you know, backpacker, camper, because I just was like, I just am who I am. Like, and I love this stuff. It was really fascinating to me.
Wow. You know, that is so inspiring there, because, you know, for you to say that, it kind of unplugged things, didn't it? You know, it got that mind working freely, and you didn't have to worry about those things anymore.
Yeah.
You didn't have to justify yourself. Yeah.
It was liberating. It was really liberating.
Yeah. So I got the $64 million question. I got to ask this, right? So mum and dad, you know, how were they in your life? You know, what did mum and dad do, and how did they react? And are they still supporting you now these days?
Father passed away.
Sorry.
He did. Okay. It's the life the life process, but
yeah,
he accepted it overall because I was just, you know, fastidious. I was like, this is who I am. Like, I'm still the same person that you love. And he was a devout Catholic. So there's a lot of tension there in Catholicism around
that. Of course. Yeah, of course.
Mother was immediately like, okay, I'm signed up. I'll be a gay mom. So she immediately was just like, okay, this is great. I'll join the PFLAG, which is the parents for gay children and all this. It was fabulous. And then a really powerful story, which makes me like kind of tear up a little bit, is I have a stepfather as well, who's in my life still, and he's such an amazing human being. But back then, like a lot of people, you know, in Central Working Class Canada, he was anti-gay, and he would always make fun of gay people all the time. We'd be out, and this is when I was still in the closet, and I was just like, oh God. But then one day, like, he was visiting me here in California, and he was just like, he goes, thank you for coming out.
Wow.
He said, you made me realize that there's a lot more to being gay than just being a drag queen or just being, and by the way, I love drag queens and I, like, but you know, there's this, we have all these preconceived notions of what being gay is supposed to be. And I tried to break them.
Absolutely.
That was probably the most inspiring thing I've ever heard about that journey. Like now he's such a loving, loving father figure and really, you know, cares about my husband, cares about, you know, my brother came out, like all of this. So it was really fabulous.
It's lovely to hear this story and thank you for sharing, right? I mean, this is very intimate things, but this is something I always love to do on this show, is to just let people express themselves. And if they feel comfortable coming forward with the stories, it helps other people, you know, really
absolutely
does.
Because we all have them. That's the thing. We all have our stories.
Totally.
So let's tell them, you know?
Basically then, family, okay, they kind of figured it out for themselves, you know, and your stepdad was so supportive, and that's such a great story. So what was the journey after, you know, you managed to go to Boston, you went and studied. What did you study in, just to remind the listeners?
Journalism, actually.
Oh, fantastic. Now you're speaking to a guy who's never had a chance to study journalism. I just got into the radio side of things just by accident.
You're a fabulous journalist.
I love you so much. You're so kind. You know how much that boosts my ego. Well, you know, just feeds the soul. My. But anyway, the point I was just going to make is you did journalism. So tell us about that journey in journalism. What did you learn about how to interview people and how to set things up when you're reporting on things? I'd love to know the background to that.
I started going to journalism, and then I made a departure into public relations.
Right.
Which is the, you know, the cousin of journalism, or it's the other side of the coin, actually, is really what it is.
Yeah.
I started doing public relations for nonprofits because I wanted to get their story out to the press. And back then you had to go to the media, like the newspapers and everything. There wasn't social media. So that's kind of where I went with the journalism degree.
This is where I always like to leave a little bit of a legacy with the show, is to say to somebody, if you're thinking of journalism or doing public relations, what are some of the things you've got to think about? You know, is it, it's not easy probably getting a job because there's a lot of competition when you come out of university, but trying to sort of get some experience, where would you suggest people get that experience if they want to go into that line of work?
Create, like what you're doing, create, write, share your voice, share other people's voices, get yourself out. Like the one of the beautiful things about the internet is your voice can be heard. If you want to be, you know, hired by a publication, or you want to do something that is related to that, people will actually look at what you've already done now, and they can easily do it. So if you want to start writing for a newspaper, start writing for yourself first and get that out there, and don't be afraid.
Bottom line, that one statement you've made is the most important one of the whole. It, don't be afraid. Just start it. Start doing it. Because once you start doing it, it's amazing how the ball rolls, isn't it?
It is. We just have to act. We have to be brazen. And we all have that self-doubt. And I think if we acknowledge that, then we can move past it.
So how did you get over the self-doubt? You know, when you first came to sort of work for, you know, I don't know, an organization, I'm not sure if it was a newspaper or a journal or, you know, on the public relations side, where did you first work?
So I did an internship at the Boston Globe, and then actually moved into a nonprofit in New York City where I lived for a while, Junior Achievement, which is for teaching students about business literacy. It's an old school nonprofit institution. So I was working for them, and that's kind of where I came. But, you know, interestingly enough, I didn't really step into myself and my self-confidence till I was probably about 30.
I agree with you there. Actually, I found it more actually into my late 40s, early 50s. Actually, that's where I really got my confidence.
Me too.
Yeah, if you can get in your 30s, you're very lucky for sure. Definitely.
So one of the other things, which is, I just wanted to share this too. I don't mind being radically transparent about myself because we all, but so what really caused me to step into my confidence is I became sober. So alcoholism runs in my family. I was actually on my way. So talking about on another track, I was on a track to despair. So I made a decision that history will not repeat itself. And I really took the agency and went into a 12-step program. And once I left there and became sober, it was fabulous because I realized what I was. I went to another track, David. And that's the track that really has empowered me up to this point.
And again, thanks for sharing that, because it's interesting. If you listen back to a couple of my podcasts, I was speaking to a guy called Hal Bastian. And he was the unofficial downtown butler of LA. And he said exactly what you said. He said, there's a couple of things. He said, you know, he's a gay man. He came out. He was living in LA in the kind of late 70s, early 80s. You know, his friends all got HIV. He's HIV positive. He said, but he hit the bottom. He said, you know, and he hit the drugs. And he said it was so difficult because once you're on those wagons, getting off is incredibly difficult, as you know. But what he did say is that the thing that helped him was a purpose in life, right? He managed to help downtown rejuvenate. He got himself a dog, a friend in life, you know.
Yeah.
And what he did was he had some great support to get on, you know, a detox program. So, you know, thanks for sharing that, because that is so important for people to give them hope that they can change the life, get on that other track. What was the biggest step though? How did you manage to get the confidence to go on that 12-step program?
I was tired of the track I was on, and I realized I had to get off of it. I knew it. There was something in every cell of my body that knew that this was not going to work anymore. And it was so scary. And I think this is like, just like you talk about how people are changing careers and changing their lives. It's that taking that first step is always so scary, but you feel in your gut level that it's something that you need to do.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm sure when you started this whole podcast, it was the same thing, right?
You're telling me.
Energy to do this.
It's interesting. You're right about the energy to do it, because usually it's a catalytic thing, isn't it? It's where something has happened in your life. And you say, well, what the, I can't say it on live on air, but what the F, you know, I'm just going to do it. If they're going to let go of me, they don't know what they're missing. I'm going to go and do this. And so sometimes it's anger. Sometimes it's resentment. Sometimes it's fear. Sometimes it's love. You know, it's so many things that as human beings were quite complicated, you know, and what motivates it. But yeah, you're right. When I first started out, I hadn't broadcast since 1995 because I had a little bit of a background in radio, right? But that was when I was younger. I had no fear, you know, what the heck, you know? And I thought, God, a mid-50s guy, who the heck wants to listen to me? You know, that's where I was coming from, you know?
And totally.
And surprisingly, they do. And it's a bit like you and your business. You know, people really appreciate what you're doing and they listen to you. So that's a great segue, by the way. I'd love for you to remind the listeners a little bit about your business, okay, and how they can get a hold of you and Cynthia, of course, if that's possible.
Sure. So Cynthia and I are in a partnership. So she has her own business. I'll share that. Mine is called Samana.life. And I'm redoing the whole website because we're reimagining who we are in 2021. Samana, by the way, is a Sanskrit word for equilibrium.
Nice.
So going back to what we were talking about. So the whole mission of our company is to get people into equilibrium. And that can mean so many different things, but it's about balance. Stay in balance.
And Samana.life is the website. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes. And then the course that you attended, which is the Activate Resilient Leadership, is in partnership with ChangeWorks Lab, which is Cynthia Scott, who I think is going to be a guest ultimately of yours as well at some point.
She is. It was wonderful meeting both of you, because I'm going to get it in stereo now, which is wonderful.
And exactly.
I'm really looking forward to speaking to Cynthia. And she's coming up, I think, sometime in September she's booked. So I'm really looking forward to speaking to her as well.
And now it's my time for the shameless self-promotion, because the five steps that I went through and that you went through, one of them, is really powerful for people and it's easy to follow. So we're making a book, and then we're going to start offering more courses, and another one's coming up in September.
Go ahead and promote. So what will be the name of the course? Is that it got a specific name?
It's the 5 Habits of a Resilient Leader.
Perfect.
So that's the 5 capabilities. So you have a capability, but how do you turn it into a habit?
If anybody wants to get a hold of you, what's the best way to either get information about the book or just to drop you a line?
You can email at Eric, E-R-I-C, at samana.life. So that's S-A-M-A-N-A.L-I-F-E. So Eric at samana.life.
Do you have a LinkedIn account that we can get a hold of you, or Facebook?
Yes, I'm on LinkedIn. I'm searchable, and Samana is on there as well.
And Facebook as well? Am I right in thinking you've got a Facebook?
Yes, on Facebook.
Excellent. Okay, we'll look out for you guys on that. Okay, well, listen, you know, it's been inspiring talking to you. I've really, really enjoyed it. And again, the candidness is so wonderful to hear. And I think, you know, if we can inspire people to make that move, take that leap of faith, change their life, be it, you know, in terms of a journey or somewhere they've got to go, or to actually get a hold of, you know, you guys and to come on the course, that would be wonderful. It would be a great thing.
Yeah, thank you. And I just want to reiterate, yeah, candidness is important. Like we all need to share our story. We're all going through something, and we all have the capability to change our lives if our lives aren't going the way we want to. So the sign behind you, like, maybe I'll just take a left to Alaska instead of going up to Banff.
Yeah, absolutely.
My point is, we all have to stay open and understand that we're in this together, and it's messy, 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 but it's fun. And this is the human experience.
Listen, I got one question before you go. And I always ask all my guests this before they go. If you were 18 again, what would you tell yourself?
Stop doubting yourself. That's it. We have too much to bring to the world, and the world needs us all. So bring it on.
Well, on that note, Eric, I want to thank you so much for coming on, and it has been a pleasure. And I've really enjoyed our journey today.
Likewise. I'm so glad I discovered this podcast. I will be a fan, and I will be following you.
Oh, well, as they say, I'll pay you later, okay?
Right.
Have a great day, and thanks again. Take care.
Take care.
You've been listening to On Another Track with me, David Wilson. My guest this week was Eric Satanarski of Samana Life, giving you the tools to navigate in the new world and thrive in it. Remember, there are more conversations coming up in this series. Just look out for On Another Track on your local podcast platform and subscribe. This has been a Britcam production for Urban Aspect Incorporated, keeping us safe on the roads of North America.